Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, strap on your hiking boots, grab your trusty walking stick, and don't forget the bug spray as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
This is Monsteropolis, a show about monsters, anomalies, and legends. I am one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined by Mark Matzke.
That's me. Hello. And welcome.
And also sitting in with us right now is one Adam Dugan, who you will not hear because I couldn't get his microphone working. We were in the throes of lizard mania, and now we've moved on to, I believe, UFOs is the current subject of interest for us. We got an email. Did you read it? I forwarded it to you.
I didn't click the link, but I read the email.
Okay,
that's
so
as far as I got.
Do we want to read that on the show? Because he kind of is, I guess we can read it
and then
come back to it.
Just the email itself had enough creepy stuff in it. I was like, what?
Yeah, I have 37 emails, just non-spirit deals. Do you guys want me to read my spam mail?
Spirit deals? Like
Spirit Airlines.
Oh, okay.
Cars.com, Pizza Hut, My Best Buy, credit card.
Like the Halloween store.
Oh, no, that would be good, too. Charles Passons, I'm guessing. Is how you. Do you want to read this?
Oh, okay, sure.
Because I can't read.
Oh,
I got
full
know
disclosure.
How. Full disclosure. I don't actually know how to read.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I'll just read everything.
Blame my mom.
All right. Hey guys, I found your podcast recently and have been binging it. I don't know if that you should do that, really.
Yeah.
As an aside, I was curious if you had heard of something called the Indian Lake Project. It's a blog, link below, about a box found partially buried in the woods. In it was supposedly pictures, film, and documents about experiments done on children in the 50s, pictures of kids in cages, etc. Eventually, the blog stopped updating as the owner mentioned strange phone calls and visits from MIB types. It's a really interesting read and supposedly part of MKUltra. Just curious what your thoughts were or if you'd do an episode on it. Thanks, Jason.
Anything involving children is terrifying to me. And I did not click on this.
I didn't either.
but we will, we'll look at it. Like maybe cause I actually like the idea of listeners suggesting topics we've never heard of and things like this kind of fall within those parameters. So, it is definitely something I will consider doing.
I'd consider doing it. My knee-jerk reaction to it, now having read through it again, is that it sounds almost like a fictionalized podcast setup to me.
Are you calling me out over JBHs and the Black Helicopter conspiracy?
I'm thinking more
where
of
where I fell for a parody website.
No, not at all. I got sucked into listening to some like that Blackwood podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So that's more of what it's based on.
Hmm.
I'm still holding out hope that tree octopuses are.
Yeah, real. That's whoever did that website that hooked me with that props to you. We should do an entire episode about that.
Someday we'll do hoaxes. We'll do like hoax month or something.
So we're gonna talk about UFOs this month, but it's kind of vaguely structured. I don't know how we're structuring this. And even this episode that you're listening to, I don't know how this is going to play out. Because as of right now, my idea is that we're just going to talk about this book And then hopefully it leads into a second episode that will go into some tangentially sort of connected side stories. I don't know if that's how this will all play out. And then we're going to talk about UFO crashes.
Yep.
So we're going to start off with, why don't we get into this book, which you just texted me about on like Monday.
Yeah, it was weird. It was weird. I've found myself killing time in libraries lately for a variety of reasons. Yeah,
I don't think that that's weird.
I know. Yeah, maybe not.
Strangely enough.
But, you know, it's not too often that I stumble on a book in the, you know, unexplained section that I haven't seen before. And the library that I was at, which is in Mentor, Ohio, had a variety of books that were all new to me, one of which is called Aliens in the Forest, the Cisco Grove UFO Encounter. And the authors are Noe Torres and Ruben Uriarte. And
Fleischer.
Yeah. Right. And so I picked it up.
Joke.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause the, and Neil Reby, incidentally, who illustrated this, is well known in Godzilla circles.
Oh, no kidding.
So it like completed the circle me completely. Cause he met, I saw him at G Fest actually.
No kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. And just didn't realize this connection.
When did you find the book?
The like one day after I texted you.
Okay.
Like, so it was Monday or Tuesday of this week. So the
one day before,
yeah,
you texted
from the past.
Okay, hold on.
When I got back in my device,
yeah.
And time traveled, yeah, after.
All right,
I found it the day before, and what it purports to tell is this again a story that I had never been exposed to before. The abduction encounter that was actually self-prevented by a man named Donald Shrum. And it took place in the mid-1960s, and it kind of crosses streams with the aerospace industry and the U.S. government and cover-ups and so forth. And it's just pretty fascinating.
Yeah, and it's probably worth mentioning, like, we're in the, not the middle, but at the beginning stages of filming on the trail of UFOs. So I'm deeply ingrained right now in, like, UFO research, probably more so than anything, which is, I need to rectify that because we have two movies coming up. But I've been doing a lot of like UFO reading. But when you said about this book, or mentioned this book, I got, I was interested. I was, like I said, I can't read or
it's a new adjective
or speak apparently. But no, as soon as you told me about it, I was excited to check it out because I'm so much of UFO, it's like Bigfoot, like so much of UFO lore is just repeating the same stuff over and over. You know, like Flatwoods and Roswell and all this stuff has been repeated ad nauseum. And so when you said it was something you'd never heard of and seemed to be very interesting, I looked it up on Amazon and bought it on Kindle. And then I found another book by these guys. Did you buy that one too?
No.
Okay. I bought that one on Kindle too. I haven't gotten into it obviously. Cause
the Mexican Roswell.
Yeah.
Is that the, yeah.
Yeah. There's a Russian Roswell. We should do like other countries, Roswell, an episode that's entirely like, exotic Roswell.
Yeah. Right.
But yeah, so I bought it as well and I've read roughly 60, maybe 70% of it. So I'll be able to, for once, dear listeners, I've done some semblance of research and I'm excited to actually be able to talk about the subject at hand. The story, just to mention this, like the story is in a, you know, the West Coast, which I've just returned from. So that also drew me in. I mean, it was an easy buy for me because I wanted to delve into a story I've never heard of. Do you want to do like, how do we want to do this? Because the story on its face, it's really straightforward.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, not straightforward at all, as you'll discover. But like, it's basically a UFO abduction attempt over the course of like 12 hours.
Right.
But the year is really important because it's something we're going to discuss in the next episode, and then also just sort of how this all plays out, and the fact that it's kind of preceding some of the famed abduction stories like Travis Walton, who gets mentioned repeatedly in this book, and some of those really well-known abduction stories. This comes before those. So why don't we just kind of play it out the way the book does and tell it piece by piece.
Sure.
and go through, and then we can both sort of comment on the different aspects of how this case plays out. And just for listeners, and we're not trying to, I don't think we're trying to dissuade you from buying this book and doing this. In fact, even in the 20 minutes we're going to have to go over this case, you're not going to get a third of what's, you're barely going to scratch the surface of what's in the book. So we highly recommend buying the book, which is available on Amazon and Kindle.
Yeah,
which I keep wanting to call Kimble.
Kimble.
Amazon Kimble.
Yeah, and the thing I think that is persuasive about getting the book in your hands is it's heavily illustrated with a lot of really good stuff that was generated both by Shrum himself and then is sort of elaborated upon by another artist named Neil Reby. Mm-hmm. And it's just pictures of the site where this all took place and maps that make it very clear as to, you know, how the event played out. So the illustrations and so forth, I think, do argue in favor of getting the book into your hands. Mm-hmm. And it's not an expensive buy anyhow. So unless there's a huge rash of people who already know about this case, which may be true, because mm-hmm. I'm just a student of ufology and its literature, but I think the great detail that this goes into is just fascinating. So should we start at the beginning? You know, it's 1964. You have three men, one of whom is Shrum, who go out hunting, and it's bow season. It's not a rifle season yet for hunting, so they are bow and arrow hunters. And there is an area of Northern California.
It's like a national park, right? Mm-hmm. Or some sort of park.
Yeah. The Tahoe National Forest.
Yes.
Of Northeastern California. And so the three of them go out hunting. They're somewhat acquainted with each other. I wouldn't say that they're good friends per se, but mm-hmm. they all are employed by the same industry for sure, and maybe even the same company, which was a company that builds missiles. And they were involved with a company called Aerojet General Corporation.
And they paint, or at least two of them, right?
Yeah.
Are in charge of painting the rockets or the jets. Or
Shrum started out as a welder and then became a painter.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, even though they have what might seem like sort of a meaningless job, I don't believe you can just be anyone and get that job. Mm-hmm. Like I would assume you still had to have background, even in the 60s in working. You know, like you said, just not to turn this into a commercial for this book either, but there's a lot of like photographs. I don't know why I said the word photographs that way, but photographs of like the location where all of this plays out. And a lot of like the sketches and his remembrances of everything that I really strongly recommend people check the book out. And it's like $6 on Kimble. So make sure you
on Richard Kimble.
On Richard Kimble, it was the one armed man in a UFO with the broomstick. Don Shrum was a married, like just sort of a typical blue collar American dude. He had a 1 year old daughter and a wife at home. He was going out with his buddies to hunt. They get up into this Tahoe National Forest, and they set up base camp, and then almost immediately, if I'm not mistaken, Don heads out on his own. Correct?
Yeah, they start taking different ridge lines essentially, mm-hmm. and they didn't have walkie talkies or anything like that.
Yeah,
so they tried to maintain visual contact with each other. That lasted for a time, but then Don went off kind of on his own. And that's when he becomes separated from the other two. In fact, all three of them get separated away from base camp. Mm-hmm. Two of them make it back. And Don's the one who didn't get back to base camp until the next morning.
Right. It's getting late and he's out there and he realizes he is not going to be able to get back to base camp before it gets dark. And this is a very rocky, dangerous sort of terrain. He's afraid he could, you know, break his foot or break an ankle or break a leg or something on all these rocks and everything. So he sees a tree and decides he's going to, as you would as a Arnold Schwarzenegger era predator dude. He decides he's going to sleep in this tree. So he makes his way up this tree. What does it say? Like 12 feet off the ground?
12 feet.
Mm-hmm. Like 12 feet off the ground. I did read. I'm blowing your mind right now. I can see it on your face. He goes like 12 feet up this tree. It's going to be funny though, because there's going to come a point where I don't know anything and it's going to be quickly apparent. But he goes up this tree and settles in for what he assumes will be a very uncomfortable night sleeping in a tree, but hopefully avoiding the bears and other. There's a lot of sort of, I don't know how to, teasers in this book where the writers love, like, little did Don Shrum know he was about to have the fight of his life.
Yeah, there is. That's a technique throughout the book. Is, yeah. Reviewing what has happened and then stating what's happening now. And right. Then the foreshadowing comes out in sort of a suspenseful way.
And you know, we're going to miss a lot of the little details. So I'm going to let you maybe take us to the next point here. Which All right. Is...
Well, he's resigned himself to being in this tree for the rest of the night and settles in. That's when he begins to see a light in the sky. That at first he chalks it up to a meteor. And later on it would become evident that one of his companions by the name of Alvarez, his last name, also saw some sort of comet, or you know, he identified it as something he couldn't explain later on. But the point being that now he sees this light, it grows bigger, and ultimately... just this great description of the what he would come to call the mothership of a craft that at first seemed very small, but that's because he was just seeing one small light on the craft itself, and that it was constructed evidently of some sort of light-absorbing material. And the closer it got to him, the more apparent, and as the sun was setting, evidently he was able to see more detail in the craft. And he wasn't sure at first if it could sense his presence there or know that he was there. He didn't think so because he was in hunting camouflage, and he thought if he kept very still in the tree that he would be okay.
But also a sense of the scope of the thing, I think he could get, at some point, I think they said 200 feet across or something, like a massive craft. Yeah. And one thing, too, we should probably mention, so the third man, Tim Trueblood, if I'm not mistaken, yeah. Tim, they don't know if he saw the craft. He kind of disappeared after, I mean, he was there and, you know, they all came out together, but he kind of dropped off the face of the earth after that. They believe he moved to Hawaii or something like that. But he never acknowledged seeing it. But having been where he was, I would assume if this is real, he had to have seen something that night. But so the other thing though I wanted to mention is that the level of detail in the book is really astonishing, because you're getting everything through multiple interviews that Don would have told the investigators that wrote the book.
Yep. And what happens next is that he sees a flash and sees an object that he was never able to, you know, determine what exactly it was in the moment, drop out of one of the side panels in this mothership craft. And then he sees a smaller lighted object also come out of the craft and land late, you know, in a little bit distant from him. And that's when things really start to take a turn for the worse, as far as he's concerned, because he starts to hear crashing sounds coming through the underbrush.
And then last,
right,
like
up to the base 10, of his tree.
10 to 15 minutes, he's hearing this something approaching through the, which sounds like a horror movie. He's hearing something coming through the undergrowth, and then what emerges is two, if I'm not mistaken, right, the humanoids are the first things.
Correct.
He sees.
Yes.
2 4-foot tall. Is that what it said, or something like that? It might not. Maybe I'm mistaken when I'm saying that. I'm not sure it gives a height. Anyway, these two, are they white suited or metallic suited individuals that come out of the forest there?
It's light colored.
Okay, light colored.
Whitish silver, possibly so, whitish silver.
And this will come into play, I think, in the next episode when we talk to my dad a little bit. But these two humanoid like figures, it's two, right? Or two,
yes.
They come out of the undergrowth and sort of approach the tree, or no, at this point they're just sort of gathering.
They're almost like they're milling around taking samples of some of the plant life.
This goes on for a very long time, which is one of my issues with it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like my intention is never to debunk this stuff, but I did find one of the hard to swallow elements of the whole story for me is that the entire thing takes place over hours, like over the course of the entire night. And these are supposed to, these guys are interplanetary travelers. If we're assuming these are space aliens, they've got a ship that has traveled light years to Earth or through a dimensional portal or whatever. They can't get a guy out of a tree. Yeah. Like for hours, they can't get a guy out of a tree. So I want to talk about that again when we talk about the white vapor and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you bet. I want to really make sure that we describe the facial elements of these humanoids because that's probably the most unsettling part of their description. It says the creature's head, the humanoids' heads, were covered by either a tight-fitting hood or helmet. Its face was dark and featureless. The only striking characteristic that Shrum could discern were two large circular eyes that made it seem as if the creature were wearing welder's goggles. The eyes, like the rest of the face, seemed void of detail. So it's almost this blank slate with these two large eyes. Having said that, it makes it sound almost alien gray. And I don't think that's what he meant to describe at all. It's more like a hooded figure, almost like comic book, like some of your hooded villains.
Like AIM.
Like
AIM, right? Yeah, like AIM, right. AIM soldiers or something. Yeah, that's what I thought as soon as I read it.
Mm-hmm.
And even the illustrations that are there. Now, what did you think of the eyes? Because the eyes come up repeatedly. It keeps repeating the phrase, those eyes. Because this entire event affected Don to such a degree that he basically had PTSD from it. He would wake up in the middle of the night screaming about the eyes and would constantly repeat that. I guess he was terrified of owls moving forward because of the sounds that these creatures made and all sorts of stuff. But the eyes, to me, it almost sounds like they were wearing a mask or something over their face rather than there being actual eyes that he was seeing. And even the way that it was described and sketched seemed that way to me.
Yeah. It seems completely ambiguous because the description is always like goggles, but never says they were wearing goggles.
Yeah.
And it, you just get the impression that if they were eyes, then they're just void of emotion and they're just looking, you know. Shrum ultimately felt that he was being threatened by these things. And I guess that's the source of the fear is that as they were, you imagine he's in this tree, they're standing at the base of the tree, looking up at him and not being able to read their intent is sort of the source of that fear.
And
just a basic fear of survival.
And that's definitely the case with the other being who shows up on the scene, which is he hears more of the sort of crashing through the undergrowth, and the next thing he knows there's a huge robot. And this is the point where I was like, all right.
Right.
This is the greatest book ever written. Because anybody who knows me knows that I adore robots, especially like Robbie the robot, which is what I pictured the entire time I was reading this book. But basically the story takes a turn here, and all of a sudden you've got what he describes as robotic or robot, you know, type figure showing up on the scene, taller, bigger than the other two guys, but clearly either somebody in a metal suit or a robot. And the robot seems a little more menacing than the humanoid type creatures, because the robot, eventually they notice he's in the tree. Well, I don't want to jump ahead too much, but basically like he's observing them and they seem to be more interested in observing their surroundings. They're taking like samples and things like that from the ground. Is this around the time where he throws the coins down?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet, but it is the place where
in the world was that?
Well, I don't know. I think the robot is probably
a UFO.
Yeah.
Oh, that was the live feed. Okay. Did you end the live feed? Okay, that's what it was.
Yeah.
It freaked me out for a second.
It's not the robot after all. Good. Yeah. No, but this would be the point to mention the owl sounds.
Okay.
This is at the time that he was noticing the changes in their activity.
Right. Right. Yeah. Because at this point, he felt like I think it's even worded like he's kind of like lucked out. Like he's observing these aliens and he's having a good time in the tree and they don't seem to notice he's there. And then things all of a sudden take a turn.
Right. And one of the things that he seems to notice is that they make a cooing sound or like an owl call type of sound. And then they receive a similar signal from the mothership.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever that happens, they change their behavior or what their activity happens to be at a particular time. And that, as you said, that would go on to be something that Shrum was menaced by for the rest of his life. You know, he'd hear an owl and he'd immediately start thinking, reflecting on this experience. And it's after a number of those sort of calls and responses that they start to get wind of his presence in the tree and all of a sudden become very interested in evidently trying to get him down.
Collect him as one of the samples that they're collecting. There are references to some of the, is it ore or what is, there's something, some sort of prominent mineral that's been collected here or something like that. But regardless, there's a theory that maybe they were there trying to collect some sort of sample because this is an area rich in X. I can't remember what it is. I guess we should start skipping ahead here because we're running out of time already. Sure. But Robot shows up. Robot seems like his sole goal is to get this guy out of the tree. And he spends the rest of the night essentially attempting to get Don out of the tree by unleashing some sort of what they call white vapor.
Right.
Which is like a gas, you know, and it seems to be like an asphyxiant. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Asphyxiant. Because like it'll shoot this vapor at him. It reaches him.
It comes out of his mouth.
Yeah.
And rises up.
Which is super great.
Yeah.
I love this robot. I want to meet him.
He stands at the base of the tree and vapor issues from his mouth. It floats up and knocks Shrum out for an indeterminate amount of time.
Yeah. You know? And it happens almost immediately. Right. Pretty much as soon as it hits him, he's out. And he'll come to, and the thing's still trying to get him out of the tree. And this is where I have an issue. It's like, this thing can't just, like, climb the tree while he's out, or is he only out for seconds? Yeah. Or this UFO that's hovering in the sky, or any of their UFOs, the scout ships, they don't have some sort of, like, beam they can beam him out of the tree with. They don't have... Like, he's 12 feet off the ground, just slightly higher than my parents' basketball hoop in front of their house.
Yeah.
Like, it's a hard pill to swallow when you're reading it from, like, as a fictional story, this sounds great, and I'm really excited about it. But when you, and having said that, I'm not calling into question this guy's story because I don't know. One thing I said to you after I finished reading it last night or the night before was that I want to see this guy. I don't know, you know, like I'm unable to, and I didn't have time to really go on YouTube and try to find any interviews with this man. I don't know that they exist, but I would like to hear him or see him tell this story because I have a lot of questions about the story since it is so in your face. Like there's a lot going on here, but there are an equal number of questions that arise from reading this. And at the same time, there's an intro by his wife that would lead you to believe this incident genuinely messed with this guy for the rest of his life and his family. Like in general, it messed with his family for the rest of his life.
Ruben Uriarte, the co-author, has an afterword where he basically builds a case for his veracity, or at the very least, he says he believes that he was not lying.
Yeah. And it's, so it's a very over the top story, but the witness just from reading this seems to be a believable witness.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens next after the vapor?
Well, like you said, then the humanoids get into the act, but they cannot seem to master the art of tree climbing.
Climbing this tree.
Yeah. And that's when Shrum does some things that, you know, it's all based on survival instinct, basically.
Lighting things on fire.
Right. And, you know. He had a number of boxes of matches at his disposal, and he figured out that the fire would make them retreat for a time. So he would light things on fire and drop them. When he ran out of boxes of matches, he like lit his hat on fire. And basically anything that was ignitable, he lit, and they would retreat for a time and then come back. And it should also be noted that, you know, he at a certain point climbs up to a higher point in the tree, like about as high as you could go without it failing under his weight.
Mm-hmm.
And he was industrious enough to kind of loop his belt around the top.
Yeah.
So that when he would be knocked out for however long, he would, you know, the weight of his body would be supported by the belt and the tree. Mm-hmm. And because I think that he had a clear sense that if he would have fallen out,
I had issues with the belt thing.
They would have come and collected him.
I had realistic issues with the belt thing. A belt, a loose belt, is still only going to give you a foot, maybe. I mean, a foot would be a lot. I mean, just think about how tight a belt is, and maybe things were different in the 60s. But if you're looping it around, like how thick is this tree that he's up in the tree? It's got to be pretty thick. It's got to be a pretty good size tree.
Yeah.
For him to be sitting up in this tree and looping it around, that would have to, that belt would almost have to wrap around him twice for that to be a realistic way to hold him to the tree.
Right. But he also had, I don't know, I think he had branches in front of him and his crossbow.
Yeah, the crossbow.
And so we
probably should have mentioned that too. Like he actually tried to shoot the robot with the crossbow or with the bow at one point.
He hit it like twice, at least twice.
And I love the illustration of like the arrow ricocheting off the robot.
Mm-hmm.
This goes on until over the course of the night while he's laying there. Now, one thing, did we mention like he threw coins down at these things at one point?
Yeah.
Because that kind of comes into play as to why he thinks they were there to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, exactly. And that after like the morning spoilers,
he makes it.
The stuff he doesn't find at the base of the tree are the coins.
Mm-hmm.
Really weird. The thing that really struck me from an emotional beat was that he, at a certain point it says he considered just committing suicide,
literally jumping out of the tree.
Yeah. Just, this is too much. And it was his wife and daughter and wanting to see them again, essentially, that his survival instinct kicked in and he decided whatever I need to do. Again, I mean, just the filmic potential of this is really pretty strong. But like you said, then he throws down everything that he can think of, and then everything sort of climaxes with another robot appearing. Did you get to that part?
I got through. I got all the way through his encounter.
Okay,
so I made it out of his encounter. I was into the cover up.
Okay, cool. So the two robots meet at the base of the tree, and some type of energy arcs between them, and they send up what is the largest wave of gas, and knocking him out for how long we don't know. But when he came to, I think that's when he starts to see the first inkling of, you know, the new day.
Yeah.
And all the robots, the humanoids, all seem to have taken off.
Yeah. It's and his, so he stumbles back to base. He does eventually collapse.
Mm-hmm.
What's the other guy's name?
Alvarez.
Alvarez finds him. And helps him back to base, and eventually they take him back, you know, back home after he gets some sleep. What happens after that? Because that's the point. I got into the cover up chapter, and that was where I bottomed out.
Well, that's like you said. I mean, he goes home. He doesn't initially talk about.
Yeah, that's worth mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is not something he runs to the media with, and in fact, it's very. It seems like he's very very hesitant to put his name out there. Mm-hmm. It, in a way, it reminded me of Lynn Keithai, the Phoenix Lights witness, because he was seeking answers. Like, he was trying to find out what had happened to him, similar to Lynn, who we just interviewed. And it just, there were similarities there where he doesn't necessarily come forward with who he is and talk about his sighting until much later.
Yeah, it's a family friend, I believe, that knows someone in the Air Force that arranges initial meeting. Mm-hmm. Because he wants answers, you know, potentially to what had happened. And that's how he starts to get into the sort of the pattern of being interviewed by people from various agencies. And I think NICAP gets involved. I forget
There were other sightings that night. That mentioned that other people saw this craft, mm-hmm. the mothership, yeah. it would be assumed.
Right, right. Yeah. Alvarez being one.
Yeah, well, but like outside of their little group, mm-hmm. I think there were other people that saw
right.
it.
Right. Yes, there were.
Interesting. Okay, so wrapping up on the story because we're running out of time.
Okay. Well, ultimately,
yeah.
They return to the site, and it's during rifle season now. And what they discover and what Shrum is convinced of is that some type of team has been on site and has gone through and removed any items that he left behind. There were a number of items, he said. It looked like, to his perception, that the area had been raked over, which, you know, you have to understand, this is rocky territory, mm-hmm. so you imagine sort of a gravelly base layer that it had been carefully turned over and anything metallic removed. And what was also found at the site were numerous cigarette butts and packs of cigarettes, you know, empty, which suggested to him that after his initial interview with the Air Force that, or even sooner than that, that the area had been investigated, any leftover evidence perhaps had been taken away. Certainly some of his camping supplies had been taken as well. He did volunteer, I understand, one of the arrows that he shot at the creature or the robot and gave it to the Air Force for testing, and it was never given back to him, mm-hmm. even though it was said, we're just going to test it and give it back to you. Well, that didn't happen. And so there's, you know, the seems fairly clear that, at least to his mind, that they had gone in afterwards and done some level of investigation.
The book is called Aliens in the Forest. You can find it on Kindle, Amazon. and I, again, highly recommend it. And disclaimer, I was not attempting to debunk anything by talking about the belt. These are just questions that come to my mind when I'm reading
sure.
a book like this. But very interesting. And I'm going to finish it, even though we've already done the show, because I was involved. And I thought just in reading it, he seemed very believable. The fact that so many people vouched for him and that there were corroborating sightings of the craft is very interesting in itself. Anyway, this is Monsteropolis, a show about legends, anomalies, monsters. You can find us on Facebook. Find us on Twitter. We are not on Instagram. You can find us on Gmail, monsteropolismail@gmail.com. Send us a letter. We'll read it on the show. Possibly do a show about whatever you suggest. And obviously we're talking about UFOs. So if you want to talk to us about UFOs, send us your UFO related email. You can leave us a rating and review on iTunes or Google Play or any of those platforms. That would be great. By the time this is coming out, do we have events? Okay. So yeah, we do. Over the course of this month, we have a few events. Next week, which will be the first episode, this episode you're listening to will actually be tomorrow. Let me think. So actually Saturday, Mark and I will, and Adam, will all be at the Johnson Humrick House Museum in Coshocton for a screening of the entire On the Trail of Bigfoot miniseries. So if you're listening to this on Friday, the 26th, is that, or 25th? What is the date?
Yeah, tomorrow would be the 26th.
Yeah, Friday. So on the 27th, we will be at the Johnson Humrick House Museum in Coshocton. So come hang out with us there. August 3rd, myself, Jason Udis, and Zach Palmisano will be at Lola's Coffee House in Cincinnati. apparently we're speaking. Originally, this was supposed to be a signing. I don't know what happened, but
you're speaking.
I guess we're speaking, but I'm not preparing anything. So, so get excited.
An extemporaneous small town monsters.
That is a free event. And we'll probably just talk about filmmaking more so than like scary stories. Mm-hmm. Cause, and then August, then there's a break. And then on August 17th, I believe it is, I'm speaking at MUFON of Ohio's conference in Columbus. I'm a UFO expert now cause I read this book, part of this book. so you can hear me talk about UFOs. No, I'll probably
wear a robot cosplay.
Robbie. I don't know what I'm talking about. I asked them and they said it doesn't have to be UFO related, but like we want you because of your knowledge about the paranormal and cryptids and things and filmmaking. And I was like, all right.
Wow.
So that's August. And then August, the weekend after that, which I don't know the date, it's August. I'm frantically trying to pull up my app on or my calendar on this new phone. August 24th, it's the 22nd through the 24th. I'm at MI Paracon, which is sort of the big Paracon. It's one of the bigger Paracons. I'll be screening Terror in the Skies, and I'll be there all weekend. And there's a lot of other people there, John Tenney and the New Kirks, who everybody loves. And
it's in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, is that?
S-T-E, Mark. S-T-E is how it's written online.
Oh.
Is that one of them? Is Sault Ste.?
Sault Ste. Marie. Okay, I don't go in for all that abbreviation.
I didn't know. I thought it was just Sault Marie.
No.
That's what it is. That's I'm an idiot. It's Sue and then S-T-E. Like I said, I can't read. In September, we have a bunch of stuff. We're doing a screening, the premiere of Momo is September 6th at the Kentucky Theater in Lexington. Will be at CryptidCon all that weekend. Really exciting. On September 13th, Friday, September 13th, 7:30, we are doing the Ohio premiere of Momo. And this will be a big deal because we're going to try to get as many of the people that are actually in the movie to that event as possible. It's at the Canton Palace Theater in Canton, Ohio. I'll be there. Pretty much most of the crew will be there for sure. Like Zach and Jason, Luke, all those guys will be there. I'm assuming you and Andy and probably Sue since she's in it.
Yeah.
Potentially your mom and dad.
Yep.
A lot of people will be at that event.
There's talk of a bus being taken down.
Is that real?
Yeah, it's real.
Oh, wow. I didn't even get invited. I went on the bus. So that's a thing. And then also, I get the bus from church.
Yeah.
Wow.
Seriously.
I got to get a bus. This isn't fair. and then on September 20th at the Mothman Festival, as part of the kickoff, we have officially announced that date is also the official release date of Momo. So that Friday, September 20th, is also the kickoff day for the Mothman Festival. Are you going to be at Mothman? We had talked one time about you going to Angels. And yeah. All right. So Adam might be at that as well. That is going to be sort of a fun kickoff to the Mothman Festival. We're screening Terror in the Skies and then following it up with Momo to celebrate the official launch of the movie. And then after that, it gives us a bit of a break. I'm on a break, as far as events go, well into November. So I think I'm off all breaks or all events in October. I actually canceled an event. We're going to focus on finishing up filming on the Trail of UFOs and starting filming on the Mothman Legacy. So anyway, if you're wanting to meet up with us, those are the events. And we want to hit up more of these. I think we want to do more of these Monsteropolis live shows. That was a lot of fun.
That was a blast. Yeah.
So if you're a listener and you have a suggestion for a place where we could do a live show, let us know. We might go ahead and try to schedule something here in Wadsworth. So if you're local and in Northeast Ohio, what we want to know is if we can actually draw members of our audience to the show. Because that would be, if we could get 20, 30 people from the Monsteropolis audience, that's what we want to do. So if you're interested in that, let us know so we have some sort of feedback that says we could actually get people to come listen to this. That's it. Well, more episodes coming soon. Thank you.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com and is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.